Welcome to International Tax Bites, designing the perfect international taxation system. This is a short series of episodes which focus on the design and functioning of the international tax system, each featuring a guest who has expertise in the international taxation arena. We hope you enjoy it. Just a quick note, in this episode, we talked to Paul Eastwood, and he's asked us to make clear that any comments he makes during this episode are his own. They do not represent his employer, KPMG, or any previous employer. Enjoy the show.
So, Harriet, here we are for the last guest of our mini-series, Designing the Perfect International Taxation System.
Yes, and I think we're really close to having cracked it. We've got a perfect tax system all set up and ready to go for everyone.
Well, I think we've got an idea of what we'd like to do. This has been delayed because our guest has been poorly, hasn't he?
Yes.
So apologies to the listeners for the slight delay, and this is slightly out of sync where it should be. It should have been two or three episodes ago, but there you go.
Not get hung up on, you know, episode order.
No, let's not do that. Because you'd never listen to anything we do if you did. Right, so who is he?
So today we have Paul Eastwood. He is a tax partner at KPMG, working out of Jersey in the Channel Islands. And Paul is here today to speak to us about the place of small, lower tax jurisdictions within the international tax system. And we are delighted to have him here.
Nice to meet you, Paul.
Nice to meet you too. And thank you for introducing me by my illness before we even get anywhere near to me personally.
So, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. You may not know, because you may not have heard the other episodes. In fact, you almost certainly haven't. But one of the things that we've been looking at is how different types of jurisdiction with different aspects in them sort of interact with the international tax system and how that might be improved. So we've spoken to a couple of people where we've talked about less developed and developing nations. We've talked to Daniel Bunn about the US
and how it refuses to cooperate.
It doesn't want to play at all. And so we also wanted to talk about sort of the features that you might see in these smaller, lower tax jurisdictions. And we feel that we can have a fantastic conversation here today, because Graham is based in Gibraltar, you're based in Jersey, and I spend an awful lot of my time talking to all of these small jurisdictions, and of course have been based in Jersey. So I'd like to think that we are the three minds to get this sorted. What do the small jurisdictions need? Graham's just blinked at me in a really shocking way. They're like, what the hell are you on about?
I nodded.
Oh, did you? I'm just not used to you agreeing. So first of all, I think what I mean by a small jurisdiction is a jurisdiction with a small population, often islands, frequently considered to be low tax or former tax havens. And interestingly, just before we started recording, we were having a conversation about how some of these places are perceived as having 0% tax when that's far from the truth, but that perception follows them around. A lot of them also have unique constitutional positions. And many of them, of course, Jersey, Gibraltar, Guernsey, are connected to the UK, but not all. And I went and did some digging for this. So we have the Cook Islands, Guam, Puerto Rico, the US Virgin Islands, Hong Kong, Aruba, and is it Niue? N-I-U?
Niue.
Niue, there you go.
Is Norfolk Island still? I used to see Norfolk Island companies a long time ago, but that's another...
Norfolk
Island, Australian Dependent Territory.
I'm not sure. I've not come across that one in my, obviously not that extensive research.
They send a bowls team to the Commonwealth Games. I know that about them.
Well, bowls and tax, not necessarily the same, but
no.
Yeah. We'll maybe have to research that a bit better.
But there's a lot of dependent territories, right? Or things that are effectively dependent territories.
There certainly are. And I don't know, and I'm going to ask Paul about this. They seem to play a disproportionate role sometimes in the international tax system because of how they are viewed. Would you agree, disagree, or neither with that statement, Paul?
Yes, I think I probably would agree with that statement on the basis of, you know, we each of these jurisdictions, I'm sure, would not like the, you know, no longer thinks the label tax haven is appropriate anymore. But the international view, or maybe the popular view, is that they are still tax havens, and that label just creates a natural interest in them, and so much of what has happened in the international tax arena over the last 15 or 20 years seems to have been focused on addressing the tax position in relation to our islands. So yes, I think I would agree with your statement that there seems to be a disproportionate amount of focus on islands such as Jersey, Guernsey, the Crown Dependencies, etc., and all those other places that you listed.
And also some that I probably haven't mentioned, but I'm sure they might get a mention. So interestingly, one of the things that absolutely blew me away when I read it, and we covered this in a previous episode of International Tax Bites, episode 54, for anyone who wants to listen to it. The end of last year, there was an OECD corporate tax statistics report, which looked at effective tax rates as opposed to headline tax rates. And they said it was very qualified. They said, look, we need to do a lot more research. But ultimately, what that showed was that for corporates, and I can see you nodding, either you've read this or it's not going to surprise you at all what I'm going to say. For corporates, slightly more than half of the very low tax rates that were being paid, the effective tax rates, were in high tax jurisdictions.
Yeah, so I've seen the research that's been released by the OECD on that front. I suppose in previous discussions with sort of the OECD and other bodies, I think there's always been that recognition that our tax systems, in terms of the taxation of corporate profits in particular, are perhaps the right word is transparent. You know, let's take Jersey for example. The standard rate of corporate income tax is 0%. You know, there is very clear clarity over that. You know, then you go to other jurisdictions, and due to the amounts of reliefs and exemptions and everything else, as you say, you then end up with low effective rates being achieved through other mechanisms, and regularly you know one of the points that the small jurisdictions would make in any discussions that they have is that it is right to look at effective tax rates, and sometimes those rates onshore, and this has now been backed up by that research, are some way distant from the headline rates. There you go. That's a polite way of putting it. That, yeah. You know, headline rates are one thing. You have to look at the tax system as a whole in order to work out what effective tax rates are. And a comparison using effective tax rates is probably a more accurate and a more reasonable way of comparison between us and elsewhere.
That doesn't make quite such good headlines in the Daily Mail.
It's not as easy to explain, is it?
No, I mean it's a lot easier to explain, to your point, in the Daily Mail, to say, you know, here is a tax regime where the corporate income tax rate is 0%, rather than I will now take you through the details of a participation exemption and outline what that means in terms of effective tax rate. Somehow I think that may not quite cut.
It's not emotional, is it?
Cut through in the same way. Exactly.
Do you think maybe it's part of that pressure comes from the fact that the other side of that, which is that 0% is saleable as a product, but there are TCSPs in Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man, Gibraltar that have built a business on it's easy to understand, whereas come to the UK and open a car factory and we might get you some relief on R&D and we might get you some relief on this and there's a participation exemption and blah, 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 is easy to understand for a large corporate because it has a massive tax team, but it's not easy to understand for an individual or for a medium-sized business or for a...
Yeah, and I suppose taking it the other way in terms of, you know, what do these islands sort of talk about on from a tax side? It's really is that thing of certainty of treatment, and you know you receive or you take some tax advice in a jurisdiction here, and the advice can be clear in the sense of, this is the treatment, this is how you will be taxed, and that is outlined clearly and for want of a better expression, unambiguously. You then, in different jurisdictions, yes, you might again get the same effective outcome, I get the same effective rate, but the number of steps and the number of reliefs and the conditions that sit around those reliefs is just, that advice is just much more involved than it would be
Yeah.
here. And I
And you have
think
to be so much
we
bigger, and you have to engage with government, and you have to do it. So I'm not picking on them, but it's a good example I can think of. Nissan's plant in Sunderland attracted government support, right? As far as I remember from the news reports, let's just say that, right? So it attracted, if it did attract government support, a medium-sized business can't do that. It can't come to the UK and say, I'd like to open a warehouse. Please engage with me about. The government will just say no, but they can get certainty if they go to a low headline rate jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I suppose also it's that certainty going forward as well, isn't it? Of stable regimes, i.e., if you're sitting there in a different jurisdiction and you're relying on a particular relief, and in order to be within the scope of that relief, there are all these conditions that apply to that relief. Stability somewhere else, other regimes may be less stable, and those conditions might change on you during the course of that investment period, which may then, result in a different outcome. Whereas, as here, the regimes are incredibly stable.
Is there another side to that coin, which is where you have smaller jurisdictions, they don't necessarily have access to the resource to administer themselves a vastly complex regime? Is there anything in that, or?
We definitely resourcing is an issue, absolutely fundamentally an issue. I mean, it's different in different islands as well on that front. I mean, let's take, if you take somewhere like the Crown Dependencies, they have all had income tax for, nearly 100 years now. So they do have the backbone of an administration system. And so, where international pressures are then asking those jurisdictions to add things onto their domestic tax system, they at least have that backbone. So that I don't, there's still a load of resourcing challenges, and having the resources to understand what those changes mean and then implement and then administer, those resourcing challenges exist across the Crown Dependencies. I think what you've also got to recognise in terms of resources is particularly where some of these international tax changes are coming out, and they are requiring jurisdictions which just have never had a concept of income tax or corporate income tax. Not only are you asking them to engage with this legislation, but in terms of resources, they've actually got to go away and build a whole new administrative backbone. So
Is it
they, you know, they.
somewhere like, is it Bermuda that's never had income tax?
Quite so, Bermuda and some of the things that it's doing at the moment around Pillar Two, putting that to one side, simultaneously at the same time, Bermuda has then got to build, for want of expression, a better expression, a tax office, and that isn't something that you can build overnight. That's something that takes time and effort and resources. You've got to create the legislative framework for that, but then you've also got to go and find the people to actually be able to do that. Are you going to find those people in Bermuda?
Probably
That's
not, just because they've not ever been embedded in that sort of system.
But there will be, but there will be an urge to find them in Bermuda because that will go to a national question of you can't bring somebody from the UK and they act like they're in charge. And there's politics there, which goes beyond the OECD and into the actual question of whether Bermuda is a nation and its self-development and self-government. I know in Gibraltar, you just couldn't bring somebody and plonk them as the Commissioner of Income Tax. It just wouldn't wash.
And I think if we go back to the Bermuda one for a second as well, because you've got to build that tax administration from the ground up, you need to think about how that administration then that piece of law and that body, for want of expression, then interacts with the rest of Bermudan law, and that needs local understanding and local knowledge of the broader legal framework of Bermuda. So to your point, Graham, you can't lift someone in who turns up and says, well, this is how it works in the UK, because that may just not work with Bermudan law. So this challenge around resources, I think, is particularly acute at the moment for low tax jurisdictions who are, there's one thing grappling with Pillar Two legislation, et cetera, and other legislation that's coming out, but it is a much broader challenge than that is going to be resource hungry. So finding the people to be able to deliver this in a number of jurisdictions is going to be a massive challenge. And to your
Interesting.
point,
It's one that I suspect is shared with less developed and developing nations, because one of the things that we've learned, well, I've certainly
yeah.
learned, is that because they tend to have sort of indirect taxes as opposed to direct taxes, income tax tends not to be the base. They don't have that infrastructure either, and they have exactly the same issues around building it.
And they're still very paper-based as well, aren't they? So when we spoke to Johan Hatting in of University of Cape Town, he pointed out that CRS and VATCA in some of these jurisdictions, developing jurisdictions, is just a completely ridiculous idea because they have it's not computerized. Yeah, so that they've had to build information technology networks simply to provide information to the Americans.
So
For
there
no
must be
benefit.
a global demand for tax administrators who can go into these places and build systems from the ground up. But as I say, wherever you do that, you've still got to be sympathetic to the local environment. There is definitely not a unpack a box and here's a tax system out of a box, or sorry, here's a tax administration system out of the box, because if you try and do that anywhere, ultimately, it's going to fail because it's got to reflect the local environment,
Is
and
it?
that can be as different between Jersey and Guernsey, although most of the world sees them as one place. Even then, you would have to be sensitive to the differences between the islands.
So even so, is Tax Inspectors Without Frontiers not supposed to be that?
Yes,
But does it just
I
import
mean.
standard OECD thinking and ignore the exact effect that you were talking about? Because that's what I would be afraid of.
I mean, to be fair, in my experience, Tax Inspectors Without Borders has not tended to sort of work. I don't mean that with in the sense of it. Historically, there just hasn't been a relationship between them and jurisdictions that we're covering in today's session.
Okay.
It's been more focused on developing nations, etc., and they tend to look at islands such as Jersey, Guernsey, Crown Dependencies, etc., onwards as not really fitting within that box. Now, whether that changes in light of the challenges that these jurisdictions, our jurisdictions, having to cope with at the moment, and they say, do you know what, actually, Tax Inspectors Without Borders should now interact with these jurisdictions, we'll see. But I don't disagree that this is a massive challenge, and it can't be a solution out of a box. It's got to be, yes, there are some fundamental building blocks, and I'm sure we've all seen them in the OECD guidance that they've given over the various years around best practice around tax administration, but it's got to work locally. It's got to work with the local law, etc. And that requires knowledge of the local environment.
So, sorry, Paul may have noticed me putting my hand over my mouth to laugh then, which is because, as Graham will know, OECD guidance is one of my favourite bugbears.
You've started her off now.
No, because, you know, sometimes it's not practical or it's not useful or it's not applicable.
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It always avoids the question you actually want answered. It answers the question you can work out for yourself and never answers the question that they've either not thought of or they avoided. That's what I find.
I suppose any document drafted by so many different people always ends up with that sort of approach.
You can feel it when you read it. You think they can't decide what that means, so they've just ignored it. And I need to know what it means.
So years ago, I would have said it's a camel, a horse designed by committee. But since having horses, I think horses are horses designed by committee. So perhaps it is a horse rather than a camel. But yes, I mean, obviously, administration is one of the big challenges of sort of participation in the international tax system. So I think I've referred
but
to
that's,
that.
As that's essentially about being a recipient of things that are delivered by the OECD or by whichever rulemaking body we're talking about. But the rulemaking itself, we've got the inclusive framework, which is supposed to be the parliament for tax jurisdictions. How do you get the same? Do you see the same problem with capacity? Because there is a similar problem. It was explained to us by, I think it was Umbakiso, wasn't it? It was either him or Carlos who said, you know, the budgets just aren't enough. Like the countries like Botswana or Angola or Namibia don't have the budget to send two people to every meeting of the inclusive framework. So they just can't participate.
Yeah. I mean, I have huge sympathy for that, which is, you know, the inclusive framework definitely has its benefits in the sense of allowing all of these jurisdictions, including the smaller jurisdictions, to have the possibility of a seat at the table.
Something, of course, the UN wouldn't facilitate necessarily.
Quite.
Yeah, we'd all be excluded, wouldn't we, if the UN took over, because we're not nations, not states.
Correct. So you know, to give the possibility of having a seat at the table is you know, clearly beneficial, but that definitely, you know, the cost of going to Paris. So, you know, I'm sure during the COVID years when it was, you know, inclusive framework meetings were done over Zoom, etc., had, you know, the benefits of limiting cost. But, you know, having previously been at those meetings as sort of Jersey representative, a lot of the most important interactions are actually done in the sidelines of the meeting. And if you are not physically present, you can't be in those sidelines to have those discussions. And so, you know, from a Crown dependency perspective, we're in the fortunate position that, although Paris is not very far away, it probably takes an inordinate amount of time to get from the Crown dependencies to Paris just because of flights and the way transport links up, but actually, you know, being realistic, it's not that difficult for the Crown dependencies to actually make it to Paris and participate, and the cost is not prohibitive. But for other jurisdictions, you're absolutely right. This is, you know, coming to Paris for a couple of days is a big commitment, and you're usually taking very senior people out of your organization locally. They'll be traveling for, you know, possibly 48 hours out of a week, and then locked in a bunker in Paris. But as I said, from experience, if you're not physically present in inclusive framework meetings, yes, you've got a seat at the table and you can be on Zoom or on Teams or however they structure that now, but lots of the best interactions are, you know, we need to talk to this delegation about this particular issue. You're not going to do that in plenary. You're not going to raise your flag. But being able to have that conversation in the sidelines of the meeting and talk to people about things that are important, that's where the real value is. And if you're not physically present there, and I understand what you're talking about, the challenges for jurisdictions about actually having people there, they are missing out on the opportunities that the inclusive framework presents to actually get matters and issues raised in an appropriate format.
So two things there. First of all, I'm so jealous that you've had a job that involved having a flag to raise. That sounds amazing. Second of all, so sorry, we should say
this is what the listeners want.
Yeah.
Somebody who's had a flag. Paul, I hope you don't mind me saying, but we have to get it in. Paul was formerly Deputy Comptroller of Taxes in Jersey, which is why he has such an important job with, apparently, I now know, a flag. Fantastic.
I've had my own flag. I can confirm that. Yes.
They're not letting you keep it when you leave.
Sadly not. I should have kept it with me in my current job, and whenever anyone was annoying me, I could just, or in partner meetings, I could raise the flag to raise particular issues.
I've actually got a question. Was it just one of those cheap tourist £2.50 ones that you can buy on the seafront, or was it a specially handcrafted one?
Somewhere in the middle, I'd suggest. I think it was a little better than a sort of a plastic straw with a. But you know, it is just a well. There were definitely meetings as well where, in the end, you had the word Jersey written on a card, and if you wanted to raise a point, you turned your card on the side so it sat vertical. So sometimes it wasn't always the flag. Sometimes it was just the name card instead.
Insights that you get doing podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this is the essential stuff. So that was the first thing that I wanted to pick up. The second thing I wanted to pick up on, you've talked about these sort of interactions. Do similar jurisdictions tend to sort of band together? Or, so, I mean, would you see the smaller, lower tax jurisdictions and the developing nations sort of banding together? Or was it more complicated than that? Or can you not answer that question? Because
the shifting sands of international relations. I mean, being sort of open on that. I mean, historically, the crown dependencies for 15 to 20 years have not, so Jersey, Guernsey, and the Isle of Man have not really competed on tax matters, and so have worked together, I think, in the international tax environment. And partly that is around having common interests. Some of that actually is back to the point you raised earlier about resources, which is if you can bring together a number of people from each of those jurisdictions, you might suddenly have 9 brains working on a problem rather than 3. And so you can share the burden, you can share the thinking, etc. So
your shared guidance on the economic substance rules is a great example of that.
Absolutely. So sort of, you know, economic substance is probably the best example of the three islands really working together to develop the legislation, and then, as you say, actually issuing joint guidance around how the rules work. So the crown dependencies have worked together. Then relationships between the crown dependencies and, you know, Bermuda, Cayman, etc. Again, where there are common issues and common goals, again, you would definitely see groupings in the OECD sort of working together. And again, it would be, you know, this is an important issue to us on this point, and have you thought about this, etc. Increasingly, I think at the time I was starting to, as I was leaving government and coming back into the private sector, I think increasingly there was work being taken to sort of make sure that grouping didn't become isolated, though, that there were talking to onshore jurisdictions as well, and about common issues and common concerns. So you might be looking at other investment hubs such as Singapore, for example, where there was definitely some common ground, and making sure that people understood each other's perspective on problems. So there is definitely there are definitely groupings which work together and share resourcing. Whether that's, I don't think that's all jurisdictions, though. I think that that's fair to say. And definitely some jurisdictions in the time I was there, and I won't name them, tended to keep themselves to themselves and have particular issues and particular concerns that they wanted to raise. The challenge of resources is always naturally going to...
I think it's the small jurisdictions have to coalesce a little bit. They share a lot of things, including not having enough resources to be able to participate
as fully as they might like,
equitably or equally, whatever word we'd like to use, which doesn't say we haven't all got one vote. Though consensus, I still don't fully understand.
I'm not going to go through that now.
You'll probably break some secret rule that you're not allowed to talk about. Nobody talks about, because the first rule of consensus is nobody talks about consensus. It's just, I'm going to use my statistic now. Harriet likes
I do like this statistic.
I've got a new statistic. The HMRC have more people on the payroll than Gibraltar has adult human beings. It's just not possible for us to sit in a room with HMRC or with the IRS or with the Hacienda in Spain and talk on the same, deploy the same resources and expertise. It's just not possible.
So I'll tell you a couple of anecdotes from that. I mean, sat in the OECD, and obviously you go on a fairly regular basis and you get to know some of the characters who are there, and you know, they, a major European country had a rep to the inclusive framework, and their job is to be the rep on the inclusive framework, and they would on certain matters they would raise their flag to talk about the resource constraints that sat upon their tax authority as a consequence of some of the changes that were being considered, and you'd sort of have a sideline conversation with them about the size of their tax authority to our tax authority locally. And I mean, it just did not compute that you could, you know, theirs was a factor of 100 bigger than ours locally. And I always remember that one day I had to step out of the meeting because in my role in government, it was all tax matters. So I had to step out of an inclusive framework meeting to have a discussion about the application of parish rates in Jersey, which is the localest of local tax matters that you could ever wish to imagine. And it was as the rep of the other country said, he could not comprehend how my brain could swap from parish rates matters to international tax reform within sort of the same hour. And it was back to this thing of, well, this is the challenges that small jurisdictions have, that we all have to wear so many hats and deal with so many matters. And you know, I'd love to be in your shoes that I could just be the representative to the inclusive framework, but that's just not the way it works. I have to deal with this, how many rateable quarters are being assessed in the parish of Grouville is an important matter for someone locally.
Yeah, so
I guess the follow-up question to that really is, do you think the scope for the smaller jurisdictions to work together more? If so, in what way? And do you see that happening anytime soon?
So I pause because I think my reflection on Pillar 2 is actually an event at which the jurisdictions might reach different conclusions. And what I mean by that is I think, let's take economic substance as the previous one, where I think in the end, when the challenge of economic substance was laid down, all of the jurisdictions that had to meet that challenge sort of quite quickly reached the conclusion that they would rise to the challenge, they would come forward with legislation, et cetera, et cetera. And after sort of the basic legislation was sort of agreed internationally at what economic substance legislation needed to look like, it was pretty clear that everyone was going to do broadly the same thing, and that's sort of where we've ended up. I think pillar two, because each of these jurisdictions, although maybe from the outside looking in, the public perception is they're all the same, actually they're not, in terms of their different industries. And what I mean by that is, I think historically the islands have been in a situation where, you know, they've created an environment which delivers tax neutrality and appropriate regulation, et cetera, but really the industries that have set up have set themselves up and have ended up being clustered around expertise. Yeah. So you'll end up with different locations being involved in very different areas. So, best example, I think, is insurance, where, you know, there is a lot of insurance, obviously, in Bermuda. There's a lot of insurance business in Guernsey. There is absolutely no insurance business whatsoever in Jersey.
You don't get many gaming companies in Jersey either.
No, gaming not part of the Jersey environment either. I think pillar two, although the jurisdictions need to work together, I think each of them then needs to stand apart and say, well, hang on a minute, let's look at our particular economy, let's look at where the interactions with other jurisdictions, and really we need to come up with an answer that works for our jurisdiction. And I remember being back in the first OECD meeting where the very genesis of P2 was starting to be floated, and I remember stepping out and sitting with other Crown dependency representatives and sort of saying, do you know what, this might be the first time, might be, not saying it is, but it might be the first time that we reach a different conclusion about what we actually do, because the changes need to reflect our specific local needs. So yes, they need to work together for all the reasons we've already talked about influence, resourcing, et cetera, but maybe we might come out with quite different answers. And you know what? That's okay, as long as each jurisdiction understands why it's reached the conclusion that it's reached.
I think that understanding is a big, is probably harder to achieve than it is to say.
And you know, that's a lot about understanding, you know, having the data and understanding your data. It's probably fair to say that none of us have got perfect data in that respect.
So we've got this Quad Island Forum, which is a developing institution, isn't it, between you three, for want of a better word, and Gibraltar. Gibraltar's not an island, by the way. I don't know why it's the Quad Island Forum, but there you go. That's for the local audience.
About peninsulas, you've made your own bed there.
We could just be a quad territory forum. I don't understand why we have to mention the word island, but there you go. Do you see that as because at the moment it's I think it began as AML, didn't it? And then it's sort
That's
of grown, yeah, sort of grown, and from the fact that tax authorities are central to AML information gathering, it's grown a little bit. I think that's got real potential to help be a place for conversations in a formal way, institutionalized way, with a regular meeting.
Yeah, and as I say, look, I think these in my time in government, there were definitely meetings between the Crown Dependency Tax administrations on a regular basis, and some of those meetings were, you know, pure tax administration, obviously just sharing best practice and ideas, and, you know, particularly if someone was going out to do a commissioning a new system, you know, sharing views around systems and how that procurement process could be best implemented, etc. And at the same time, and then separately to that, there would then be policy meetings around international tax policy, and sometimes it'd even be things around domestic tax policy. So these meetings have always existed from a Crown dependency perspective, and I can see why you would want to slowly grow that out, and perhaps Gibraltar is the next place to go in terms of similarity between the parties.
So looking at one of the things that I've always considered a potential sort of stumbling block in these sorts of international scenarios is an awful lot of these jurisdictions that we're talking about, obviously the Crown Dependencies in Gibraltar, they have quite complicated constitutional relationships with other larger, possibly with greater clout jurisdictions like the UK, for example. How does that work in the context of the inclusive framework?
So clearly you have a seat at the table, so you have a flag, as we've discussed, but you jurisdictions have to be sensitive to those constitutional positions. And so they'd always, you know, I don't say you'd always, but you would clearly want to make sure from a Crown dependencies perspective that you weren't about to surprise the United Kingdom. So there are always going to be channels open to make sure that the UK is aware of the position you're thinking of taking. And as I say, I think very much on a basis of no surprises, I think would be a political way of describing the situation. So yeah, and I suspect that the Crown dependencies in particular are particularly sensitive to that position of making sure that they keep particularly UK Treasury abreast of thinking and nothing comes out.
So is it sort
which
of...
Which risks embarrassing. Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, and just that you just avoid anything that risks causing embarrassment or...
So, but Gibraltar, and I cannot speak for government. I am not part of the government and would never want to speak to government, but it's... we have our own geopolitical sensitivity and therefore would not... For different reasons, I am sure take exactly the same position. We don't want to surprise the UK because there are other conversations with other people and we're subject to a territorial dispute, and you don't want to annoy the person who stands next to you in the middle of a territorial dispute.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely, an additional layer of considerations that the jurisdictions such as ours need to go through, and you have, you have to be realistic about those sensitivities, and you have to be cognizant of them, and you need to address them. And we all have to, each of us has our own particular ones, but they have to be addressed and they have to be managed.
We're not independent states.
Correct.
And that's a reality.
Is it ever helpful having that sort of relationship in the context of those? Is it ever helpful for the Crown dependencies having that relationship?
it's definitely helpful at times to be able to have a sounding board, and the UK can play that sounding board role, where you can go and take ideas and concepts to them, and they can give you a sounding on whether that sounds realistic or appropriate. And of course, they just have that again, back to that thing earlier, we were talking about resourcing, and I apologize that we keep coming back to it, but they just have the capacity to have a greater amount of people looking at a challenge. And so sometimes may just have had the ability to think more deeply about a challenge, and that's no criticism of what people do locally. It's just sometimes it's just a factor of the amount of brains that you can put on a problem. So Yeah, I wouldn't want to say it was all one way. It's not all a problem. In some ways, it can be a benefit, and also there can be benefits in the sense of if a jurisdiction can convince the UK that something is a good idea, then the UK can then become your salesman for one. Yeah, that's the word, cheerleader for an idea. So there,
I mean, it's got know, to
it
be,
isn't,
it's,
it isn't all one way.
It's got to be useful to have a direct line to the Treasury / tax authority in a big player like the UK. It's got to be useful if you're a tiny country.
Absolutely. As I say, it cuts both ways. It cuts both ways. So, you know, I wouldn't... Yeah, it definitely has its benefits, but there are those sensitivities that just also just need to be managed as well. And that takes...
It was described to me by somebody... from the UK side, I won't say who it is, that if small jurisdictions want to bear the UK brand, that those were the words that he used, the British brand, then they need to be sensitive to the position of the UK.
Yep. Yeah, I can understand that. And as you say, each of our jurisdictions that have a UK connection anyway, I think are acutely aware of that and you know, proactively go around. Managing isn't quite the right word, but being sensitive to it and ensuring, as I say, no surprises, I think, is the key thing in terms of keeping that relationship working.
Well, because the constitutional arrangements just mean that it's got to be a consideration, right? Because ultimately, I know we can argue about consultation, but ultimately Westminster believes it can make law for all of us directly at a moment's notice. Now, having done the research on the position and written a paper about this, many people would disagree. But the physical reality would be if Margaret Hodge or whoever wanted to pass something and it went through, it would be a reality we would have to deal with.
Yeah, Graham, I'm going to leave you to that one. I expect you know more about the
it would certainly the details be a the thing, right? It would be a thing. Can we just leave it at that? It would be a thing.
It would definitely be a thing. I agree with that.
And it would be a matter of concern for everybody. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, there's that. So there were just a couple more things that I wanted to raise.
And I've accidentally managed to trail my paper on it.
So... the first one was what needs to change from the perspective of small jurisdictions? What would make it better for Jersey, for Guernsey, for Gibraltar, for the Bahamas, the BVI, whatever?
Time, I think, is the simple answer to that, which is... There has just been so much thrown at these jurisdictions over the last 15 years. You know, if we go back, if I talk about it in a Jersey context for a second, you've got you know, the change from the previous regime to 0-10 regime following pressure from the European Union. You've then got the introduction of things like CRS and FATCA. You've then got the BEPS minimum standards. You've then got economic substance rules coming out of EU and OECD. And now we're all talking about Pillar 2. And I think the pace of change is too much for these, and before I forget, it's sort of almost too much for any jurisdiction, let alone a small resource constrained jurisdiction.
I was going to say, is this not something that would perhaps benefit everyone if we just slowed down and said, this is great, let's get used to A and then we'll do B?
Well, and I think in particular, it's the point around the fact that we've done so much change, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years. And I don't think we've, as an international tax community, we have. Haven't really stepped back and said, have we achieved the aims and the goals that we set ourselves by making these particular changes? Let's take economic substance, for example. clearly an important issue for the EU and then the OECD, introduced in 2019 in jurisdictions such as the Crown Dependencies, the infamous 2.2 jurisdictions from the EU listing. Has economic substance achieved any of the aims? Do we need to give that a period to bed down and understand the behavioural changes that have happened in relation to economic substance before we then move on to the next thing and then the next thing? For me, and this is a personal view, it does seem that we need to give things more time to understand what has happened out the back end before we try and fix another problem.
Like when you go on a health kick and you start drinking 3 litres of water a day and going for a run 4 times a week and eating really healthily, you feel better, but you don't know which one it was that did it, right?
But I don't think Absolutely. They do feel better. I just think they think there's more to do.
Everyone likes to be busy, Graham.
It's like, oh, we must do something. So let's do something because they're on a 4-year electoral cycle. They need to be seen to be active. It's driven by many, many different inputs, right? And I fully understand, Paul, that it would be nice to have a year where I don't have to worry about a major reform. But I think that they're on a treadmill that it's difficult to get off. And everybody said the same. Dan Needle said exactly the same in the very first episode of this. It's time to just pause and see if this does what it's supposed to do, because I am tired. And he was basically saying the same thing. I am tired of being told this reform is the one that will end it. And then the next one is, this is the reform. The CRS was supposed to stop everything. And then, oh, well, seemingly it didn't. But I just think that I agree with you absolutely, but I don't think they know what they want.
I mean, it comes back to, in terms of good policy making, you want to be able to identify what your problem is and stand back and try and identify solutions to that problem, implement those solutions, and then take a chance to understand whether you've achieved your aims. That seems to me to be good policy making.
That's exactly what Rita Zilaferia told us.
Yeah,
to your analogy of the treadmill, we're just on the treadmill, and exactly. I worry that we're not actually looking back and trying to work out did CRS address this? Did economic substance address this?
If you look at the 98, whatever that report was called, I can never remember the name of tax avoidance, a growing global problem, or whatever it was, right? That defined the problem. It defined abusive tax regimes, ring fencing from the economy, secrecy. Yeah, it addressed those problems. It made a list of people that did it. It addressed those problems. There is now nobody on that list. It solved them. But then, oh, no, but that's not what we meant.
So as I say, I think the one thing that would make things better is just more time. Just you're not saying don't make changes, etc. But it's the pace of change, I think, which is just too much. And it is a case of let's just take things at a slightly more considered pace. And as to Harriet's point, I think that's particularly acute in the smaller jurisdictions, but I think it applies equally elsewhere.
I think
it seems to be a problem of tax generally, though, doesn't it? Because I mean, I was looking at unconnected to this, I'm looking at a report HMRC had produced about how they were doing with tax avoidance. And I think it was quite an old report. But what I thought was stunning in the sense of it stunned me, not stunning as in beautiful, was that they were really excited about the fact they brought in something like 40 odd new anti-avoidance provisions. And I was like, why is that a good thing? Why are you happy about that?
Because it forces conservative behavior on the taxpayer.
I'm not sure.
Because he's not sure.
But in any event, the point that I'm really making is that's a lot of change. That's a lot of whiplash change for everybody to get on board with. And I think There is a little bit just in tax generally, though, I think particularly in international tax, this idea that you've got to be doing something and you've always got to be doing something or else you're failing.
I have no evidence for the next statement I'm about to make.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But it does feel to me anyway that there is a deliberate policy of rapid change so that you can never find your feet and you can never avoid the change that's just happened. And that just makes people be more conservative, makes entities be more conservative. I don't know if that's right, but it would be a tactic, right?
I can see that that might be the effect, whether or not it's an intended one. I think we have to leave in the open there, don't we? So I think really you answered our last question to all of our guests has been, what is the one thing that we need for the perfect tax system? Would that be perfect international tax system? Would that be time?
I'm afraid it probably is, in the sense of, as I say, I think jurisdictions, the smaller jurisdictions, sort of understand that they are part of this international tax framework, that, you know, there are concerns from outside, and that in the end the framework will change. I think there's a recognition of that. There's not a head in sand resistance to that. There is a realism, I think, in these jurisdictions. I think the call is just to do it better. And I think to do it better, you just need to do it in a bit more of a considered way. And as I say, I think there is something in particular about, you know, standing back and looking at all the changes that have been made over the last decade in particular, and saying, you know, did these things achieve the aims that we set for them? And to the extent that they didn't, why not? And then what's the next solution? What's the next thing to do that? But this continual, let's move on to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, without ever really seemingly looking back and deciding about whether those things have achieved their aims, I think is going to leave us in a, well, to my point of, I think good policy making takes time, and it takes a clear understanding of your problem and how you're going to go about trying to solve that, and then ascertaining whether your solutions have actually achieved your aims. And I'm not sure we're quite there at the moment in terms of the pace of change that's happening to us at the moment.
Well, possibly international tax bites can give the OECD a hand there, because they're always asking for our help. You know, they're like, come on, help us out here.
They refused to come on. That's what they did.
Well, I don't think they refused to come on. I think they just ignored us.
No, like, they replied. They replied, okay. And said no. But now we've got all these great people, including Paul, obviously, they will want to come on. Because we've certainly got more listeners than we used to have.
So three.
Yeah, no, us three. Okay, Paul, thank you so much for your time.
You.
It was really insightful. I am so jealous that you've had this experience of going to the inclusive framework.
Absolutely.
It's not just about the flag.
But it is in a big part about the flag. I might just buy myself a flag, actually, to wave at people.
Are you telling me you don't wander around the streets of Lincolnshire waving flags at people already?
No, I don't, but only because it never occurred to me that that would be a delightfully batty thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, the next time, Graham, you're in a partner meeting, I can strongly recommend taking your own flag in for interjections at appropriate moments.
I will.
It does feel somewhat empowering.
Let's not talk about me being empowered in partners meetings. Okay, right. So that's been fantastic, Paul. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
And it was great to speak to you. Harriet, shall we round off as ever?
Let's do it.
So this is obviously not advice. This is just a conversation between three people talking about tax. Thank you very much for listening. We've got one more episode to go in the mini-series, and it's just going to be me and Harriet chatting about whether we've achieved our goals. Thank you so much for listening. So many of you have listened over this mini-series. It's absolutely excellent. Thank you so much for your time and patience. and goodbye.
Goodbye.